We are involved in a study of getting to know Jesus through the Old Testament. And we began this study, and we're kind of still there where we began in the first 17 verses of the Gospel of Matthew. Because it's in those verses that we find Matthew's genealogy that takes us back through the Old Testament. And the idea behind all of this is that, you know, as we said in the beginning, most people, when they're learning things about Jesus and getting to know Jesus, our experience and learning about him is mainly through the Gospels. Okay? But what we're doing is we're leaving a lot of information out and unturned when we leave out what the Old Testament has to say. And so we're looking at the Old Testament to see what does it tell us about Jesus. So we've been so far looking at a lot of different areas, and we're in a section right now where we're looking at, in a sense, kind of three different divisions of time. The first one being from Abraham to David, where we looked at Father Abraham and the beginning of God's plan for the redemption of mankind, calling upon this 75-year-old man to begin this plan through the promise that God made to him, through you all nations of the earth would be blessed. And we followed the history there up into David. The time of the kingdom, and we looked at David, from David to the exile and the division that took place in the kingdom. The kingdom was established and then divided because of disobedience. We spent last week looking at the history that was taking place with the Israelite people and the world down through the period of the exile. And so this morning we're going to continue on from looking at the period from the exile to the Messiah. And so again, what I want you to keep in mind is we're looking at these things. Our study and the focus of our study is trying to get to know Jesus through the Old Testament, okay? So what do we learn about Jesus through these things, okay? There's two major things that we have to focus on when we're looking at Jesus. It's Jesus as a man, and then it's also Jesus as the Messiah. And we're going to talk more about that in just a moment. So let's take a look at this time period from the exile to the Messiah. First of all, the exile itself. Generally speaking, the exile lasted roughly about 50 years, and that is until the first group of exiles began returning back to their homeland. And, you know, it was not this massive, you know, return of everybody at one time. It happened actually in stages. That's why we refer to it as the first group that went. It's actually 70 years that took place from the time of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem until its rebuilding. This particular time frame, okay, of this period of exile, where the Israelite people, many of which were carried off into captivity, into Babylon, was a time of tremendous amount of hopelessness on the part of the Israelite people. But at the same time, it was coupled with promises of restoration. You go back and you look at what the prophets had to say. They were talking about the reason that they were there in captivity to begin with, which basically was a result of what? Their sin, their disobedience, and their turning away from God. But yet at the same time, the prophets continued to point out this hope for them in terms of a restoration, a time when they would be restored to God's favor, and so forth. And so they had both of these things. The situation seemed to be hopeless, but yet there's these prophecies of redemption. There's these prophecies of being able to return home and have what we had before. So it's a time of, in a sense, in that regard, limited punishment. Okay, they were there in captivity because they were being punished for their disobedience. It's limited punishment, but also hope for the future that God is giving to them. Another thing that we see in this particular period, that we see it in some really mighty ways, is that God is still exerting His sovereignty over all the nations of the earth. And remember, this is a big theme, and it's an important thing for us to keep in mind, because our tendency as we read the Bible, and especially as we focus on the New Testament, is to do what? What do we tend to do? What do we tend to look at in that regard? We mainly tend to focus on how God interacts with His people. You say, we look at, well, hey, Wesley, good to see you. All right. We tend to focus on God's interaction with His people and whether He blesses His people when, they're doing what they're supposed to do, and when they're not doing what they're supposed to do, then He punishes them, and so forth. And that's our tendency, is to focus in this kind of interaction. And sometimes, if we're not careful, what we miss is the important message we've been talking about all along. God is not just the God of the Israelites or of those who obey Him, but He is the God of the universe, you see. And He is sovereign over how much of the world? All of it, you see. And so God is directing the affairs of not only Israel at this time, but also of all the nations of the earth, you see. And He is exerting His sovereignty in the world, you see. So what we see happening here in the previous part, when we're looking at the destruction, okay, and the fall of the kingdom of Israel, the kingdom of Judah, we saw that God was using the Babylonians and the Assyrians to bring about His judgment on the Israelites, right? Okay, well, now they're in exile, and God is preparing someone else, okay, to in this particular point, intervene, in a sense, on behalf of Israel, okay? And so who do we find in world history at this particular point that's coming into the picture? How about Cyrus of Persia? We find the Persian Empire becoming the world power. You see? Assyria is no longer the power. Babylon has fallen. And Persia is now the world power. Okay? And it's Cyrus who is prominently figured in this particular period of allowing the Israelites to go back under his rule, and to go back and to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem and rebuild the temple and to reestablish themselves there in their homeland. Okay? And so God is using these other kingdoms. Okay? As He used the Babylonians to destroy the Assyrians, He's now using the Persians to destroy the Babylonian Empire. Okay? And all of these things are within God's plans. Okay. So God is getting things ready for, in a sense, the next phase of His work with the Israelite people. He's punished them, brought them into exile. Now He's ready to take them back home again. But there are some things that are taking place during this particular time period that are going to greatly influence the time period that we find Jesus in. Okay? Much as what we have already seen. Let's talk about the restoration itself. As we said, the Israelite people are allowed to go back to Jerusalem. They're allowed to go back to their land. They were allowed to rebuild the wall around Jerusalem. They're allowed to rebuild the temple there in Jerusalem, which becomes, you know, again, that's the center of, you know, of God's presence amongst the people and so forth. But this return, if you will, really is dwarfed in significance by the first leaving, so to speak. Okay, the first exodus, if you will. Okay, in other words, this is the second time, is it not, on a large scale as a nation that God has freed His people from, you know, captivity. Okay, the first one being, you know, from the Egyptians, of what we typically look at and think about when we look at the exodus. But this one is another one. It's very small by comparison in terms of the event itself, and then also in terms of the effects and so forth that it had on the Israelite people as a nation. It's basically the first exodus from Egypt. What did that really accomplish for the Israelite people? What are some of the things that we've been mentioning and talking about already? They left from captivity in Egypt, and what kinds of things were accomplished and established? Okay, the law, first of all. Okay, and this covenant that God made with the Israelite people, right? Okay, what else? Do what now? Okay, the priesthood and part of the which is a part of that law, and the worship system and all of those kinds of things. Okay, I'm sorry?
I was saying the kingdom, but didn't they go to conquer the land that God? They started to conquer the land that God promised?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we saw in the establishment of them coming from that exodus, we really saw them for the first time being established really as a nation, didn't we? You know, not just a people anymore, but they were recognized in that whole period as a nation of people. You see, the Israelites. This time they're going back to the land that they had, the land that God gave to them. They're going back, but they had already been established as a nation. They were already the Israelite people. They already had the law. You know, they had the priesthood. They had all of those things. They were even a kingdom at one time. So they didn't get any of that stuff. Was not anything new. What really was happening here in this second exodus, so to speak? Do what? Okay, it is. It's a restoration, basically, where God is taking them and putting them back where He wanted them to be, and where He had established them to begin with as a nation, you see? So basically we have this, they came out of Egypt and they were a nation, they were given laws, they were given a covenant, they were given promises, and they disobeyed all of that. They broke the laws, they broke the covenant, they disobeyed and so forth. So they were sent back into captivity for a short time, okay? And then they are restored back to the place that they were taken from. During this particular time, there is another important group of folks who came about, and we see them actually being opposed to the Israelites rebuilding the wall around Jerusalem and the temple and so forth. Who is that group of people? About the Samaritans. Okay? Who were these Samaritans? Where'd they come from? We've talked about them some before. Yeah. They were some of the original Israelites and descendants of the original Israelites that were not taken into captivity. They were left in the land there, but when the land is being taken over, they were intermingling with those, you know, foreigners that were there. And so they were basically half-breeds. Okay, they were not full-blooded Jews anymore. Okay, and so there grew out of this group of people this animosity between them and the full-blooded Israelites. Okay, and that animosity, we see that in some really powerful ways showing its head in the ministry of Jesus and even throughout the New Testament time, do we not? Do what? Yeah, the woman at the well, you know. How is it that you, a Jew, could ask me, a Samaritan woman, you see, for something to drink? We saw it also very prominent in what story? That Jesus told. The story of the Good Samaritan, absolutely. You see, that Jesus brings that story to light. Good morning. Come right on in. Jesus brings that story to light and emphasizes the generosity and the care and the concern on the part of these foreigners, that is, these Samaritans who were hated by the Jews, and he's contrasting that with the complacency and so forth of not just Israelites or Jews, but what kind specifically? Who were the Jews that he used in this story? A priest and a Levite. You know, this was the religious leaders of his day, you see, that Jesus was pointing out in this particular story. So it's during this particular period that we find this group of people being established and coming to be, and this opposition from them against the Jewish people. Now, they go back to Jerusalem and to their land. But what is their political condition that they're in at this time? Are they a free, independent nation?
No, they're allowed to go back for the purpose of rebuilding the temple and worshiping.
Okay.
They're still under the thumb.
Okay. They're not a free people, are they? Indeed, they are free to govern themselves to an extent. And that's basically how many of the rulers of the different empires through that particular time in history did things. You know, you're talking about empires that covered most of the known world, okay? And they would, you know, when an army, you know, the empire would come, whether you're talking about the Assyrians, when they came in, the Babylonians did the same thing. Typically, they would carry much of the royalty, those that were still left alive after the battles. They would carry them off into captivity, you say, but they would leave the rest of the folks there to do what? Why did they leave them there? Yeah, somebody had to work the land and take care of the crops and the flocks and the herds and so forth, you say. And so they would typically leave, you know, contingents of soldiers that were there just to kind of make sure that everybody behaved themselves and did what they were supposed to. They allowed people to keep their religious practices. They tried to influence them some, but for the most part, as long as people didn't stir up a lot of trouble, you know, with their things, then they left them alone pretty much. They governed them with, in a sense, kind of a loose hand. They oftentimes would allow the people to have their own leaders in place as long as they did what the empire wanted to have done. They were allowed to govern their own people. And this is kind of the condition that we find the Israelites at during this particular point. Okay, Cyrus was one of those rulers that allowed them to do their thing. So the Israelites were a small part, a very, very small part of a vast, vast empire, okay, that Cyrus had that lasted for two centuries. All right? eventually, what we find happening, and this kind of brings us to the end of the Old Testament as recorded history, what we find happening during these latter years is, again, the Israelite people find themselves falling back into disobedience again. Okay? To the point where we find Malachi, the last of the prophets that we have recorded for us, who was warning the Israelite people again about their apostasy. Okay? And thus brings us, with the end of the book of Malachi, brings us to the end of the Old Testament as recorded history. And it brings us then into a time period that is referred to as the intertestamental period, or the time between the testaments. Okay? That is the time between recorded events in history of the Old Testament and Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, as we've been looking at the genealogies, which is the beginning of the recording of the New Testament. Okay? What we find during this particular period, a lot of different things are taking place that are going to directly and in some very powerful ways affect the atmosphere, so to speak, that we find when Jesus comes on the scene in the New Testament. Okay? So let's talk about a little bit about this area, this time period of the intertestamental period. The Jews as a nation during this time, though again, we the Bible isn't recording this. We look at, extra-biblical historical accounts and so forth for what's taking place in this particular time period. We see the Jews are still continuing to exist as a community. Okay? They haven't ceased existing as a nation or anything like that. They just have very little influence on what's going on in the world. Okay? They experience, during this time period, two more power changes, okay, in the world before Christ would come. Okay? There are two more major upheavals and power changes in history during this time. Who are they? Alexander the Great, first of all, comes along and what happens with Alexander the Great? What does he do? Yeah, he came through and swept over the Persian Empire like it was, a knife cutting through hot butter. I mean, he just whoosh, just conquered the Persians in with really very little effort, historians would tell us. Okay? And Alexander the Great, as young as he was, he united the world at that particular time, the known world, with a couple of different very great influences. Okay? What were they? Yeah. First of all, it was the Greek language. Okay? Became, in a sense, the universal language of the world. Okay? In other words, during this particular time, as the Greek Empire spread, they took the language with them, and Greek became, in a sense, like English is today amongst the world, where, people spoke their own native language, but then they also spoke Greek. You see? What else happened from Alexander the Great? What else do we see happening here besides just the language? Yeah, highways. Although that's going to come even more under the Roman Empire. He kind of started a lot of that. But it's also mainly the culture. Okay, the Greek culture or Hellenization that came about, where it just spread throughout the world. Okay. And so everything became, in one way or another, in a sense, kind of attached to Greeks and the Greek culture. See? And was greatly influenced what was going on in the rest of the world. Okay? Now, Alexander the Great dies, and I think he was, somebody help me out here, was he 32 years old, I think, when he died? Yeah, I think he was something like 32 years old when he died. So he wasn't an old man. He was very young. And to have accomplished all that he accomplished at such a young age. But he died, and basically what happened, well, let me ask you, what did happen to his empire? It broke up. It was actually divided up amongst his generals, wasn't it? You see? And eventually what happened is we saw, you know, through this breakup of the empire of Alexander, we saw the development of the Roman Empire. Okay? And it's the Roman Empire that we find Jesus and the Jewish community that he was born into that lived under that particular empire. There's two main features from this particular period, that is, from this intertestamental period, two main features that put their mark on the world that Jesus came into, okay, that we really need to be aware of. Okay? The first feature, and this has to do with the Israelite people, okay, together. The first feature is there was an increasing devotion to the law, okay, amongst the Israelites during this time period. They recognized, at least in part, and apparently a major part, they recognized that the reason that they were exiled to begin with was because of disobedience to the law. Okay? And so that, in a sense, kind of gave a rise to this desire to prevent that from ever happening again. Okay? We don't want to have to, our descendants to ever have to go through what we went through with, you know, having to be, you know, taken captive again and so forth. And we recognize that the reason that God did that to us was because we disobeyed His laws. So in order to prevent that, it makes sense that we have to do what? Obey the law. You see? Don't violate the law. Well, that is a noble cause. Would you not agree? Okay? But the problem with that is, well, yeah, that's a major part of it. It created a lot of problems, okay, in and of itself. Those problems which we see arising during the ministry of Jesus and things that he was addressing, which, as you mentioned, Stephen, one of them was the problem that they had with their hearts. But what it did really is it gave rise to a structure of traditions and applications of the law that were intended to prevent violations of the law. Okay? So, in other words, what they were doing was they were so concerned about people violating the law that they had all these traditions and these rules that they came up with to keep people from violating the law. The theory appeared to be that if we can keep people from, you know, in other words, and we've talked about this some before, they in a sense kind of built a hedge or a fence around the law. And the idea is if we can keep people from crossing the fence, you see, that's there to protect the law, then we don't ever have to worry about people violating the law. Okay? If they don't get close enough to the law to violate it by this fence, you see, then we protect people from violating God's law and we protect ourselves, right? Make sense? Okay. Again, the goal and the intention was don't violate the law. The problem with that is that eventually, over time, And we're talking about a time period here of this intertestamental period of how many years?
400.
Right, basically about 400 years. Okay, and we know what can happen. Just look at our own country and the laws that we have had in our own country and the existence that we have had. Okay, and that's been really only 200 years, right? You see? And look at how things have changed and so forth in those 200 years. Well, basically what happened to the Israelites in their desire and their need and focus on trying to keep the law, that the fences that they originally put up eventually became law. Okay? So now if the law is right here, what do you have to do if you want to keep people from violating that law? You got to build more fences. And you come out a little bit further and you build a new fence around the law so that, again, people won't violate the law. We keep them from getting too close to it. And then after a while, again, what happens? More fences are needed. And there's more traditions and there's more interpretations of the law that are applied and so forth. And so by the time that Jesus comes on the scene, what do we find? Confusion based on what, though? The traditions of the law that have become the law, you see. And so the Israelite people, though the intentions were good and honorable, you see, the actual practice and effect of that was disastrous. Say, and we find some particular groups of people that arose out of the Israelite community during this time that we see interacting with Jesus, and these are the religious leaders, the different religious sects of people, like who? The Sadducees, the Pharisees, okay? The Pharisees most prominently, you see. They were the ones who were, as far as I'm understanding from history, they were the ones who really were behind a lot of these efforts to keep people from violating the laws. Okay? And so we find this, you know, by the time that Jesus comes on the scene here, what do we find Jesus constantly doing with these religious leaders? Yeah, there's constantly these, you know, conflicts, aren't there? That Jesus is being confronted by them, and then he's, you know, turning it right back on him. And what we find in the attitude of these religious leaders, not just the Pharisees, but with these religious leaders, what is their attitude toward Jesus and why? They're hostile. What is their desire concerning Jesus? Kill him. Get rid of him. Why? Well, he speaks the truth, but that wasn't really their biggest concern. Yeah, he's messing with their system. You see? Jesus is messing with their system. What was it that the high... Okay, Steve, go ahead.
Kind of as a thread through all of this, going back even to the intertestamental period, you mentioned the emphasis of on the law. And what I've kind of seen here, and you can see it in Christ and his relationships, is the Jews, even though they wanted to follow the law, they were kind of leaving God out. You know, the purpose of the law was to keep people centered on Jehovah.
Right.
And they somehow or another got the idea that, well, the law is the big thing. Right. God's not what really matters. It's this law.
Right.
And so they begin to build the hedges. And by the time you get to Christ, you know, talking to him, you can see his frustration. He says, you know, you people, you can't even think about this, you know, the Pharisees.
You know,
you teach all these little commandments, you know, and you have all this outward appearance, but you're empty inside.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
You missed it completely.
Yeah, exactly. Because what had happened in effect is that there are really three prominent figures from the Old Testament that have become the center of their focus. Where they have, in a sense, kind of, you know, God is God is out there, okay? But they didn't identify themselves as much with God as they did with, help me out here,
Abraham, Moses,
well, Moses and David. Remember, it's Abraham is our father, right? Moses gave us the law. And David is the king, and we're looking forward to the Messiah, you see, to come back and sit on his throne. So those three figures became very prominent in their thinking and their focus, you see. And God is, in a sense, he's kind of on the shelf over here. Okay? Exactly. So we find this, and the evidence is very clear as to what their real focus was all about. In the words of the high priest, you know, when you know they're trying to figure out what are they going to do with this Jesus, and he makes the statement saying, you know, look, we've got to do something with him, or the Romans are going to come and do what? They're going to come and take away. Specifically, what did he say? Our place, James, and our nation. In other words, this guy is stirring things up. He's messing with our system. And if we don't do something about him, the system that we have, that we've figured out how to live and operate and function in, the Romans are going to come and take it away from us. They weren't concerned about the truth, really. You see? They were concerned about what was comfortable. Okay? Now, another prominent thing that happened during this time is we see the beginning of synagogue worship during this period. Okay? Before this time period, synagogues were not a place of worship. Synagogue, basically, that's what it is. It's a house of worship, a place of worship that we see very prominent in the New Testament, okay, but is absent from the Old Testament worship. And this is the time period in which it really came about. Became really the center, okay, of worship and community life in the Jewish communities. Okay, so again, when we're reading in the New Testament, and particularly in the Gospels, and we're constantly reading, where did Jesus find himself going? To the synagogue. Okay? Over and over again, Jesus is going to the synagogue. Okay? So we have that development during this time. Now, the other, I told you there were two main features during this particular period. The one is this devotion to the law and all these things we've been discussing, those developments. But the second one has to do with the stirring of messianic hope, okay, that really became dominant during this particular time period. In other words, when you go back and you look through the history of the Old Testament and the Israelite people, we don't find a whole lot of this idea of a Messiah coming, you see, to rescue the people, do we? It's just not really there, okay? What we find is God restoring the people to their land and the promises that God gave them to make them a nation and all of these kinds of things. But it's during this particular time period, this intertestamental period, that the messianic hope really becomes a center and a focus of the Israelite people as a nation. They were oppressed by the Romans. Okay, they longed for the Messiah. In other words, the prophecies were there. Okay, but during that earlier period, they didn't pay a whole lot of attention to those. They didn't click a whole lot. You see, they were more concerned about what was going on with them at that particular moment and so forth. But now, they find themselves over this long period of time being oppressed, you see, and this is stirring more and more of this desire and this hope, this anticipation of this promised Messiah, the one that they had read about, that Isaiah in particular had prophesied about. Now all of a sudden they're paying attention to some of these prophecies and they're important to them. You see? Because they have a hope of this Messiah who would be king. Who would be king. And that's where David then becomes very prominent to them in terms of the promises and the prophecies concerning this Messiah that would come and sit on David's throne, you see, and establish his kingdom and so forth. As we've talked about many, many times in here, what was the main problem that they had in all of that? Their interpretation of those prophecies led them to what? An earthly kingdom. You see? They were looking for that Messiah. That was their hope. But their concept of that Messiah was one who would be an earthly king that would come in and get rid of the Romans and restore the kingdom to the glory that it had in the days of David. You see? And that's what they were looking for. And that's what served to shape their concept of this earthly kingdom. That we find the disciples even at you know, when Jesus is getting ready to go back up to heaven after his resurrection, and what's the question that the disciples, those that have been following, ask him? Yeah, Lord, are you now at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? You say, that's where they get this concept from, this earthly kingdom. And you know, they've been following Jesus all this time, and he hasn't done that yet, and they know he's getting ready to go back, and so it's a logical question, isn't it? At least from their perspective. Well, we put our faith in you as the Messiah, the king who is going to come and get rid of the Romans and establish the kingdom. Are you going to do that now, Lord? You know, you're getting ready to leave here. Did you forget about that? There's one issue we need to talk about before you go, kind of a thing. You see, that must have been on their minds as Jesus is getting ready to ascend back to heaven, right?
There was no God's intention for us to have the earthly kingdom.
Okay.
And it's too bad you didn't understand.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah.
Even his apostles, I had questioned as to what some of the things that he was talking about.
Right. Yeah, and you're right, but do you understand maybe a little bit more now why they didn't understand it? You know, when you go back and you look at all these events that were taking place during this time period in history, you know, it's easy to see where they got these misunderstandings and so forth, and their focus became so far off target. They had really lost the real focus of what the law was all about. And in losing that, they also lost the focus of all those prophecies and what they were all about that really combined to create an atmosphere that when Jesus came on the scene was ripe for the conflicts that Jesus encountered with the religious leaders of his day. They do what? Yeah, it does. It absolutely does. Okay, we're out of time again. So we'll pick up here in 2 weeks. Ted is going to be teaching Bible class next Sunday because next Sunday I'm going to be spoiling some grandkids and so forth. So Ted will be doing that. All right? So thank you all very much.